Get ready for a week-long celebration of music, community, and fabulous fun with Joy Radiothon 2024. Joy has the largest collection of rainbow podcast content in the world, and you can help keep us out loud and proud by donating during Joy Radiothon 2024. Just go to joy.org.au/radiothon. Mark it in your calendars because Joy Radiothon returns June 1st to 7th. And remember, we all flourish with joy.
Welcome to another Joy 94.9 podcast.
From Joy 94.9 Community Radio, this is the Joycast of The Fool and the Opera. In this Joycast, you'll get to hear an exclusive extended version of the weekly feature interview.
The Fool and the Opera with Dan Vo.
David Young is a contemporary composer who is very well known and widely respected the world over. In Melbourne, we can also boast that he's one of ours. To mark the opening of the Melbourne Recital Centre as part of the opening festival, his work, Thousands of Bundled Straw, will be given the distinction of being the second piece to be formed in the MRC's second space, the Salon. Thanks for joining me, David.
Thanks, Dan.
Well, let's talk about this piece.
It took about 10 years to write, so certainly it's one of the largest, longest, most complicated things that I've ever done. It's a song cycle. The duration of the song cycle is about 54 minutes. It's for soprano and 12 instruments. And yeah, I wrote it over. I mean, it's not the only thing I did in that 10 years, but I did write it over a 10-year period. I didn't realize we were second, actually.
Okay.
So yeah, that's a huge honor to be the second performance, public performance to take place in there. And the beautiful thing about this performance is it's actually the second performance of the full song cycle. But bits of the song cycle have been performed at various places over those 10 years.
It's based on a myth of the ancient temple of healing eyes. Can you tell us a bit about that story?
When I started writing the song cycle, I was taken to far west Japan, where a friend of mine lives. He's a violinist, amazing violinist, Yasutaka Hemi. And he took me to this temple where he was actually doing like a string masterclass. And so we were staying there, and it was this Ichibata Yakushi, the temple of the healing eyes. On the lake, there's a big lake there, Lake Shinji, and it's kind of up on the mountain. It's all of those romantic Japanese kind of idyllic images. It was all there, a Zen temple. I got to experience Zen meditation. I got to walk up the 1,200 stone steps that you sort of ritually climb up, and you always, the idea is you take a stone with you and leave it, a bit like Cairns in Scotland, I guess, you know, leave it up on the fence as you enter. Mm. And the myth behind the temple is of Yoichi, this fisherman, who lived apparently about 1,200 years ago. And then one day he discovered the statue of the Buddha floating on the water. And so he grabbed it, took it home, and that night it spoke to him in a dream. And it said if he threw himself off a cliff, his mother's eyes would be opened. His mother was blind. So the next day he got up, wrapped bundles of straw around himself, and he jumped off this cliff. And indeed, his mother could see miraculously, and so he founded a temple, and that's the temple.
And you came to this temple, and it must have been an amazing experience for you.
Yeah, I mean, it was an amazing experience. One of my strongest memories, actually, was of these incense sticks that the monks who lived there would make. And what they were black incense sticks, quite thick, a bit like a pencil. And then as you burnt them, it would burn and all the ash would kind of stay. There'd be like a cigarette, you know. But as it burnt down, this kanji, like these Japanese characters, would magically appear, a bit like invisible ink. And it would be kind of your fortune. So you'd burn this incense that would take like an hour to burn down, and it would reveal this beautiful calligraphy. And they, you know, that was hand painted, like the monks were doing that. Mm. There were many things about the location, about the vegan diet that the Zen monks have, about the meditation rituals, which are really full on. Basically, if you move or, you know, fidget or whatever during the meditation, then the leader comes around literally with a big stick and hits you. So, you know, it's a zone. And I actually had this weird feeling that, you know, when I'm 80, that's going to be what I do.
Right.
The beautiful idea of retirement.
While you were there and meditating, is that where this particular song cycle came to life?
Yes. So I actually started writing it in Japan. So the first part that I wrote was actually the fifth movement. So there are seven movements. And in the fifth movement, it's just for the soprano and guitar. And the fifth movement is actually made up of seven songs. So in a way, it's a kind of mini song, you know, mini song cycle within the larger framework. So that first song of the fifth movement I actually completed actually at the temple. So it was very much this moment of inspiration, and it kind of resonated for another 10 years and indeed sort of still resonating.
Been told that your work is about blending sound and image. Would it be to say that a lot of the visuals of the temple and that sort of thing cued a lot of your sound? Is that how you work or how you write?
Absolutely. It's a little bit like synesthesia, which is, you know, when you kind of get your senses confused. It's actually like a medical condition, but not exactly. When I see something, I kind of can, it's not that I literally hear it, but I can imagine what it would sound like. And so I'm always experiencing the world visually and then kind of translating it into sound in my mind. And so when I see, you know, a Japanese ink drawing, I immediately am thinking about what would that sound like if a violin played it. If I see, you know, a cherry blossom tree silhouetted against the sky, I'm immediately thinking, gosh, you know, I wonder what sort of percussion instrument would render that sound, that, right, you know, that image. And for this song cycle, there are many different visual images which have informed the music. And one of the most clear examples is an architectural plan of the region. It's actually one of the oldest regions in Japan because it's up in the far sort of northwest, which is where basically the Chinese migrated down through Korea into Japan. There's very little known about the sort of archaeological history of Japan, which is perhaps a lot to do with Japan's sort of monocultural view of the world. It kind of likes to think that it existed forever, yep, but there is some very important archaeological sites in that region. And so one of these beautiful archaeological maps where they'd found these strange stone bells, which they don't actually make a sound, like they don't actually know what they were for, but there were hundreds of these stone bells they found under the ground. So I had this map, and that map I actually used as a sort of architectural framework for the song cycle. And so the different rooms and the different spaces and entities that were mapped out on the plan are actually translated into the structure of the movements and the relationships between the durations of the movements and so on. And then at other times, quite literally, so that I sort of at times photocopied bits of this map onto graph paper and then transcribed sections into music notation for the piano or whatever.
Right, okay.
So there are those weird connections between the visual image, which are kind of then rendered in time.
Yeah, I understand that it's called graphic notation.
Well, graphic notation is certainly something that I use a lot. I mean, okay, graphic notation is has existed, well, for a long time.
So it's a general practice.
It's kind of a general practice. I mean, it was certainly, you know, developed a great deal in the middle of the 20th century. So it's a relatively new thing in conventional music.
Mm.
And I do use a lot of graphic notation. So instead of the staves and notes and rests and sharps and that kind of thing, it's you know, perhaps drawing squiggles along, you know, the stave or textures, or indeed I've worked with photographic notation or animated computer-based notation.
Mm.
So what the musician is looking at is a moving score or a photographic score. However, for this piece, there are certainly graphic elements like that archaeological map, which are, you know, underneath. But what I have done in this instance is notated it all into normal notation.
Okay.
So I've kind of done that translation for the musician, if you like.
Okay.
But these days, I like to see what the musician generates when they're confronted with those graphic elements.
Okay. Well, Deborah Kayser is the soprano for this particular piece, and she's been working with you for about 10 years now on this particular piece, and I think more beyond that with other things. For both of you, sort of working on this together, has the piece changed for you as you've both developed and matured?
Deborah was the first person to perform my music in public. We've been working together since 1991, so nearly 20 years, I guess. And one of the amazing things about Deborah is she has an early music training, so she's not trained as a sort of coloratura, you know, dramatic soprano. She's trained within that early music mode, which is much more about the purity of voice without vibrato, which I love. It's an incredibly haunting quality that she has. Mm. You know, her instrument is really quite otherworldly. And so it's been a great honour to have access to that. And it has influenced my whole career, if you like, because, you know, she was the first person to perform my music. It was kind of, you know, like learning to drive in a Rolls Royce. Mm. You know, and I think my music is what it is. It's quite challenging, it's difficult, it's very demanding of the musicians, because from a very early, you know, stage in my career, I had the good fortune to work with these amazing musicians. And so this piece, Thousands of Bundled Straw, could only exist because of that relationship I have with Deborah. Otherwise, I just wouldn't have the audacity to write something that's so demanding, right, of the singer. And indeed, you know, there are not very many people who could perform it. And certainly it's changed. I think Deborah has performed the fifth movement, the songs for voice and guitar, probably 20 or 30 or 40 times at different places all around the world. It's been recorded in Germany, it's been performed in Japan and all over Europe, and it does keep changing every time. In those songs, she's required to drop 5 eggs,
right,
as a kind of percussive element, but also obviously a dramatic element to the piece. So it's a lot of eggs. and the way that she drops them does vary from time to time. And I think, you know, we will certainly be the first and possibly the only ensemble to drop eggs in the new salon.
Sure. How do you notate a dropping egg?
It's just kind of a little egg shape and then a line with an arrow. Arrow pointing down, of course.
Going to make sure they're fresh eggs as well.
Well, strange, during the recording 3 years ago, yeah, one of the eggs was off.
Oh.
And oh my God, you could hear it from the control room. I mean, you'd smell it from the control room anyway.
And I imagine on a day like today where you've been rehearsing, where it's, I think, what, 40 degrees out there?
It's actually 45.8.
45.8. Did the egg just cook as it hit the ground?
Well, actually, we're rehearsing tonight. So I really hope Deb's got fresh eggs.
Now, in terms of talking about the fact that the piece is quite difficult, for me as a listener, I do find it quite difficult as well, because it's quite layered. It's sort of like, I sort of think of it as like listening to Japanese. I can hear the emotion and I can sort of understand the emotion, but the words themselves, I really don't understand. For a beginner, how would you like a beginner to engage with the music?
Contemporary music has a really bad name around the world, actually. It's seen as very difficult, as impenetrable, and very, very often people say to me after they've been to a concert, oh, well, you know, I don't really know anything about that. Or I don't really understand contemporary music. And very early on when I was at uni and organising concerts, and people would come after, you know, after the concert, and they'd say, oh, well, you know, thanks for inviting me, and, you know, but I don't really know about music, and, you know, you're all very clever, and, you know, but, you know. And it used to really frustrate me, because they were there in the concert. They were obviously experiencing something. And I wanted to know what that was, and I wanted to engage with whatever experience it was that they were having. And really, that's why I started my arts company, AFIDS. Mm. It was to try and create performances in which the audience felt that whatever they were experiencing was valid. And we've done that by using unconventional venues, we always try and have information around the performance, so whether it's a program note or some kind of other explanation, or just trying to create doorways into what is often, you know, difficult work. And a lot of contemporary art is really bewildering if you don't know the story behind it, or if you don't, you know what the artist has done before or whatever. So I guess when you say, you know, what do I want the beginner to get out of it, I'm just keen for them to, if possible, leave behind that baggage of oh, well, I don't know about music, or I don't understand this, or whatever, and just have an experience. And it might be an experience of boredom, or it might be an experience of confusion, or even irritation or frustration. But it certainly, over 54 minutes, it will also shift into perhaps moments of repose, moments of excitement, moments of revelation even. Very often in a concert, when I'm most absorbed in the music, whatever kind of music it is, I suddenly find it's almost like meditation. You know, you suddenly think, oh, shit, what happened? You know, right. Like 5 minutes suddenly disappear and you're off somewhere else. And it's not asleep. You're operating in a different level of consciousness, I think.
Sort of that sort of half world between sleep and awakeness.
Well, not really, because no? I think it's sort of almost on the other side of being awake. It's kind of almost hyper awareness.
Right.
You're become aware of other things. And and what you said about the work being layered absolutely is, it is very layered. It's operating, you know, at a number of different levels. There are a number of different texts that the libretto or the words that the soprano singing is made up of, and some of them are in Japanese and some of them are in Italian and a few are in English, not very many, and some in French. And they're kind of jumbled up and fragmented, almost like you're sitting in the room next to where a television is and someone's channel flicking.
Right.
It's kind of like you're overhearing this conversation or overhearing this poetry, and you can't quite grasp it, but you almost can. And so you get these little glimpses. And I think hopefully any decent work of art, every person will take away a slightly different impression of it. And hopefully indeed have, radically different experiences of it and perhaps hear different words or, hear different things completely.
Let's talk about the Melbourne Recital Centre for a moment. Can you just describe it for the listeners, the salon?
The salon, it's quite a small room, and I love small, intimate, miniature, subtle, and really this salon is all of those things. It's kind of modelled, I suppose, in a way, on a sort of 17th or 18th century chamber or salon, which is, in a lot of 17th and 18th century architecture, you'll find rooms of this kind of size for chamber music. So it's not a huge room, I think. At the very most, it would fit about 120 people. And the thing that strikes you when you first enter are the walls, which are made up of these square, blonde wooden panels. And they're all slightly tessellated at different angles. And one wall is black, but still made of these beautiful wooden panels. And they're all beveled, or they're kind of carved with a Percy Grainger graphic score.
Right.
It's quite a high ceiling, so the space is actually very resonant. It's got almost an echo to it, but that can be controlled by the acoustic panelling, and it's got all the latest mod cons and so on. And then the floor is made up of this pressed bamboo, which again, is quite light. So it's a very light, wooden, simple, beautiful space.
And in terms of your piece, now I understand that you've had 25 3-hour rehearsals in there. Has the piece changed to suit the space?
We haven't had all our rehearsals yet, so we're still in the process of rehearsing. And indeed, not all of them are in there, unfortunately. Okay. But yes, and so one of the things that one of the things we're looking at is the acoustic panels and how, exactly how to create the ideal acoustic in there, which is almost a luxury of, an embarrassment of riches in that you've almost got too many options.
Right.
So we're changing the space, in terms of modifying the acoustic panels to suit the piece. But the main difference is that this piece has been performed in larger venues, basically. And what happens with a larger venue is that the musician just very naturally and instinctively projects to the back row. And in a space not only of this size, but also where the acoustic is so pure, the room is absolutely silent. It's literally balanced on springs so that you don't get any vibration from the trams going past. It's totally isolated. I mean, if you're in there and all the lights are switched off and nothing else is in there, you can actually hear your own heart beating.
That's amazing.
It's an anechoic chamber. I mean, it's quite incredible. And this means that the musicians can play at a dynamic level that would otherwise be absolutely impossible. So they can play very, very softly. And in a way, it creates this incredible intimacy. It's almost like the musicians are playing for themselves and you just happen to be there.
Yeah.
So that is radically changing the work. It means that there's much more delicacy and nuance. And it's, as someone who's interested in that kind of thing, that subtlety, it's been incredibly exciting.
I had an interesting experience in the Elizabeth Murdoch Hall. I watched a talk by Evelyn Glennie, a deaf percussionist, who talked about, you know, listening to music through your throat or through your fingertips. And I found that the Elizabeth Murdoch Hall really lent to a very physical experience of the music. Is the salon a similar space where you really are just enveloped by the music?
I think even more than in the large hall, the Elizabeth Murdoch Hall, simply because of the size. And also, the larger hall is very dramatic visually. Mm. There's all that wood. You know, it's quite overwhelming, I think. Whereas the salon is much, much simpler. And I think you're almost able to focus on the sound more in the salon.
And as the composer, like, do you still hear the music and, you know, it takes you to a certain place, or, you know?
It's just all completely terrifying. I don't hear anything. Well, that's not entirely true. I mean, certainly first performances, I never hear anything. I have to wait till I get the recording before I know what happened.
Oh, really?
Because I think it's to do with control. Not that I'm a control freak. But during rehearsal, you can interrupt, you can suggest, you can guide, you can make comments. But in a performance, suddenly you have to just sit there and shut your mouth, and you're really handing over all of the control to the musicians. And it is, it's a very heightened, anxious experience, yeah, for me. But I guess because I have such confidence in these musicians, and because of the time that has passed since writing it, I'm actually really looking forward to maybe hearing it for the first time in performance, in a way.
I know a composer who's very passionate about having his works recorded. I understand the salon is, you know, built so that works can be recorded there. Do you have a similar sort of desire to have all your works recorded and sort of catalogued as a sort of a memento?
Well, if you'd asked me this 15 years ago, I would have told you that I was absolutely uninterested in any documentation whatsoever in terms of photographic or recording. And indeed, there is a whole series of performances and projects around that time, which, you know, there's a few snaps that my mum took and that kind of thing. But I'm increasingly interested in documentation and the importance of that. However, I have to say, there's nothing that replaces the live performance, and particularly with a lot of the projects I do, which involve not just music but also other elements, whether they be architectural or food or martial arts, or, you know, so there's a physicality, there's a sense of being in a space or moving around a space, which is impossible to document, whether even with video and photographs and text and so on. Nothing will ever replace that live performance. So I almost see the recording process or the documentation process as a completely different creative process altogether, different artwork, and quite separate from the performance. So in this case, the performance actually will be recorded, but it's a recording of the performance. And for me, the most important thing is the performance. I'm not that concerned about the recording, really, in this instance.
Let's go back to the temple for a moment.
Okay.
And I understand that every few decades, I think it is, they take out the bundle of straw that...
It's a statue of Buddha.
Statue. Oh, okay.
The one that he found floating on the sea.
Ah.
Supposedly, they take it out every 100 years.
Okay.
But the last time was like in the 80s. So I'm really hoping that medical science improves a lot in the next, you know, 70 years.
Well, I was going to say, would you make the pilgrimage back to see it? Well, clearly.
I so would. Yes, back in time.
Well, as you like your unconventional spaces, do you ever imagine your piece perhaps being performed in that temple?
Of course, that would be a dream come true. So we are actually doing a performance in Matsue, which is the nearest town or the nearest city, in about 3 weeks. We're actually doing a performance of a music installation work inspired by an old samurai hotel in the region. And we're performing that inside Matsue Castle, which is kind of the main monument of the city up on this hill overlooking the whole town. We're doing that in the drum turret of the castle.
Right.
So we're getting there. It's kind of probably 30-40k to the temple. So, you know, step by step.
So this is an opera program for beginners. And I know that way back when you were younger, you had an opera experience that is quite memorable.
Well, I was a member of the National Boys Choir for about 8 years, actually. And one of the things that the National Boys Choir did back in the when the 80s, was it the 80s? It was the 80s, was to provide the children's chorus for what was then called the Australian Opera, now Opera Australia. And so I was very fortunate to participate as a member of the children's chorus in a number of operas. Mm. And the first one was actually at the Palais in St Kilda when they were still using it for operas. And they set up this huge circus marquee in the car park out the back. And, you know, there'd be four operas going on in rep. And so there were the dogs from Tales of Hoffman. And it was really like a travelling circus. It was quite incredible. Anyway, the opera that we were doing was Otello. By Verdi, and starring none other than Dame Joan Sutherland herself. Lovely. And I, is it the end of Act One? Maybe it's the beginning of Act Two. It's a long time ago. Anyway, I was chosen as the little flower boy who got to hold Joan's hand and walk her down the stairs. Mm-hmm. And I got to do it. I only got to do it six times because there were six performances, and she didn't turn up for a single rehearsal, not even the dress rehearsal. but she was amazing. I mean, it was, you know, pretty unforgettable holding Joan's hand and wandering down those Palais steps. There was actually a photo in the paper, so there is proof. And of course, during the season, I went into her dressing room at a certain point to get her autograph on my program and that sort of thing. And I just had a scungy biro, and I also never forget her just, you know, very politely popping the biro to the side and getting out her own pen. But I do have her autograph, a little smudge of makeup on my program from Otello as well.
Fantastic! So an experience with opera royalty.
Exactly. Yeah, it doesn't get better.
Excellent. Well, David Young, thank you so much. Best luck with the performance this coming Thursday. Thursday, February 12th, will be the Thousands of Bundled Straw performance at the Salon in the Melbourne Recital Centre. So thank you for joining me on the show today.
Thanks, Dan.
Thanks for listening to the Joycast of The Fool and the Opera from Joy 94.9 Community Radio. You can find more Joycasts and the program blog at joy.org.au/The Fool and the Opera. The Fool and the Opera is produced by Dan Vo and Jed Gilbert, thanks to the support of Joy sponsors and members. Please help support it by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
This podcast was produced by Joy Media. You can support Joy's diverse sound and diverse community this June by donating to Joy Radiothon 2024. Go to joy.org.au/radiothon. And remember, we all flourish with joy.